You're listening to The Drop-In Queer Edition.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome all. You're listening to The Drop-In Queer Edition, Episode 1, The Unspoken Queer History. My name's Owen, your host, and I'm here with my lovely co-host, Aphid.
Hi, it is me, Aphid.
And Lily.
Hi guys, I'm excited to learn some history today.
We also have a special guest for this episode who will be our historian, Drew Dalton. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us something about yourself?
Yes, certainly. So I'm Drew Dalton. I am the CEO of Report Out. So we are a global human rights organisation for LGBTQI plus people. I'm also an activist and have been now for over 20 years in the LGBTQI plus field. And I'm an author. So I'm currently writing a book called Broken Rainbow, which looks at global LGBT phobia around the world.
Very great credentials. Lovely. Well, let's get into the subject of the day, history. Now, Drew, we had a great conversation the other week on this very subject, and I know firsthand that a lot of us grew a great interest as well, which has us here today to pick your brain a bit more. For the first question I have is, what's like the earliest recorded case of any LGBTQ plus activity in history itself?
This is really difficult to say because it's a good question. It's a difficult one because what we might call LGBT now would not maybe be how people framed themselves in the past. Yeah. But in terms of recorded evidence, there is charcoal paintings in a cave in Zimbabwe from the San people.
Oh, yeah.
These date back between 13,000 years to possibly 5,000 years ago. And this shows an orgy of men with erect penises having sex with each other. There are no what you could describe as female imagery in that charcoal set of paintings, which is amazing. It just shows that millennia beforehand, before colonialists appeared and people came down from the north, that actually there were people there practicing same-sex behaviour.
So we've answered the age-old question, there were gay cavemen.
Oh, absolutely. Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Good point. And I think when it comes to somewhere like Zimbabwe, it's particularly interesting because for 30 plus years, Robert Mugabe was, in essence, the dictator of Zimbabwe. And he called homosexuals pigs and dogs. And he said that they belong to the West. It's a Western invention imposed upon African culture. Yet right in his own neighbourhood are these set of charcoal paintings, which makes for an uncomfortable truth, really, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever any, like, lesbian drawings? Because you hear a lot about, like, the men's one, but there's never really any talk about, like, gay women.
Not so much. What you tend to get is stuff really visibly appearing in ancient China, but usually around the ancient Greeks. You tend to get more of that appear then.
Yeah.
In cave images, what tends to be the role of women has tended to be around procreation. And so what was unusual about these San rock drawings of the San people was that none of this was about procreation.
It was all about fun.
But yeah, it was about fun.
What baffles me about that is that this cave painting, they thought it's such a unique and special event to put it on a cave painting.
Yes.
And that's quite neat, but I also find it quite funny.
Yeah. And some people have suggested that this act of sex actually has maybe divine influences, that it's linked to apparitions and things like this. I mean, one of the most interesting things that they discovered about the cave going forward was that the cave was actually filled full of carbon monoxide, which actually leads you to have hallucinatory effects.
Oh, wow.
So whence doing this intense ceremonial orgy, for lack of a better term, people would have also been high.
About Egypt, why were they more accepting and like the rest of the world really weren't? So what made them like more accepting of it?
It's a difficult one, this one, by saying the word accepting, because Egypt...
Well, more normalised.
Yeah, because I think at different times of the Egyptian pharaohs and the Hellenic periods, when it was more integration with Rome and things like that, the Egyptian Empire changed a lot over thousands of years. It wasn't just the big gold pharaohs that we think about. But It was definitely tolerated more at different times. So it's a really good question. I think one of the things that's really interesting is that when you came to, because the Egyptians believed in the feather and the heart. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you did good deeds your whole life, your heart would be placed against a feather on scales. And if the idea was that if they were equal, then you would go to the afterlife. But you were also asked a lot of questions. So according to the Egyptian Book of Dead, 42 negative confessions were taken from you, first of all. Have you taken part of any of these? Have you done this? So, for example, have you stolen? Have you done this? One of them was, I did not have penetrative sex with a sexually passive male. That's what it roughly translates as. However, in 1964, a group of archaeologists opened up a tomb. You might be familiar with this one. And found two men who were buried together, mummified, and their noses were touching. So in ancient Egypt, a kiss on the lips was not to show affection. You rub noses against each other to greet each other. Isn't it? It's super cute. It's a bit like the Inuits, because it's a cold, in Inuits in the North Pole, it's obviously cold climate, so you don't touch lips because of saliva, you rub noses because it's warmer. When they opened up this tomb, they found two men holding hands and kissing. A lot of people at the time thought they were brothers, or perhaps even co-joined twins. But actually, as the evidence emerged, these two guys were manicurists to the pharaoh. They had really high up roles when you consider that in ancient Egypt. To be close to the pharaoh was a privilege. Going back to the question, you were talking about lesbianism and bisexual women. The Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is actually, believe it or not, written by a woman, not a man, fun fact, actually has a suggestive phrase in there, which says that lesbians should not have sex in the temple. It doesn't say that you can't have sex anywhere else, just not in the temple, please. It's a little bit of an etiquette guide. And
like, they just discover one day that someone was having sex in that temple, so they've needed to put it
presumably.
It's like those, like, oh, when something's too low and it's like, oh, watch your head, like those for stupid people. That's funny.
It's like a little etiquette guide, isn't it? There's also another text which says, from ancient Egypt, which says women should not have sex with married women, but it does not say unmarried. Oh. So you get this idea of a certain level of tolerance at the time that changes. And then you've got other ones which are maybe trying to correct people down a certain path. So one of the gods, Seth, he was a god of chaos. And so there's a whole story about semen and lettuce, which is far too long to go
into. I know that story. I've had a deep look into ancient, like, with I have a deep interest in, like, mythology.
Oh, yes.
And deities and stuff like that. I have come across the ones with, like, semen and lettuce.
Yeah,
and
things hands like chopped off and all sorts. So this was probably a message about moral disapproval. Don't be like Seth. But that goes alongside all of the other things that give conflicting ideas. Mm-hmm. So like one of the pharaohs, King Pepi II, I love that name, Pepi, I think it's brilliant. It just sounds fun. He actually would go to his general's office at night, or his general's room, I should say, and have sex with him, it was suggested.
I was going to ask a question about that. Were there any pharaohs who participated in same-sex relations?
Yeah.
I guess that answers the question. There were.
Absolutely, yeah. And Pepi was quite renowned for it. But the Egyptians, although they were seen as much more lax as a culture in terms of sex and compared to the people that lived around them, they still use flowery language. So, you know, not to be specific, they didn't say, you know, he went and did this. They said, had his way with him.
Kind of like a very early version of Polari.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just keeping it, you know, gentle for the people. However, what's interesting is that there's an altogether very different image of the people who were the slaves under the Egyptian Empire, which were the Jewish people, the early Jewish communities. So they actually, in their Talmud, one of their religious texts, they actually said that they viewed the Egyptians as morally corrupt. As most new civilizations normally do, don't they? They look at an existing one and say, you're corrupt, we're better than you, come to us type of thing. But at the time, they actually wrote about lesbianism. And they said, that's for the acts of Egypt. So clearly it was much more widespread, obviously not in the temple, but much more widespread than what we think.
Only an Egyptian, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
So why do you think it's like, if they were so like tolerant of it back then, why do you think it's kind of opposite now? Like some stories I've heard in Egypt, they're like very against it.
Yeah.
So what do you think made that divide?
It's a very good question. I think I was writing about this in my book, actually. When Egypt started to fade as an empire, obviously collapsed over the years, and then the rise of the West happened, and the West was asserting its power. France invaded Egypt, obviously took over for a large amount of time. Napoleon invaded. A lot of local Arabs in particular were going, why are our empires declining and theirs are growing? You know, they had a proud legacy of thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah.
And because of the impact of colonialism, they started to then question themselves and say, is it because of some of our habits? And a lot of the colonialists were painting Arabs to be sexually diverse. And that, you know, the way they treat their women and, you know, those types of words, which actually sound quite familiar to today. And these kind of arguments were used, and that started to seed self-doubt in a lot of Egyptians. So when the military ruler started to come in the 1950s and 60s, and Egypt's gradually become more conservative and probably wouldn't recognize itself if it looked back thousands of years ago as a result of that.
I know Aphid has a question that I also really want to be, would love to be interested in.
So you mentioned this and it was really interesting to me because there seemed to be like art on it that seemed to be a very in-depth bit thing, and you talked about it as if it was just normalised very much in China, I believe. Mm-hmm. But that's The Bitten Peach by Han Fei. What was it kind of symbolising and what was the effect on the culture, do you think?
So first of all, probably got to explain the story of the bitten peach. Yeah. The bitten peach is it's kind of a historical euphemism about male homosexuality, in particular in China. It originates from a legend from Mizi Jia, I'll get it right eventually, who was a courtesan, who was a male lover of the duke. Basically. Okay. One day when they were out walking in the garden, the courtesan picked a peach, bit into it and presented it to the Duke. And the Duke saw that as an act of absolute affection. In fact, I quote, "How sincere is your love for me? You forgot your appetite and thought only of giving me good things to eat." Oh, this is nice, isn't it?
That's beautiful.
Lovely. It's a lovely story. It was recorded originally by a scholar who wanted to use this as a little bit of a parable, like a cautionary tale. Because eventually, after Puer Gilles, the courtesan, beauty faded, so too did the Duke's love for him, which is kind of harsh, in all fairness.
Yeah.
But eventually, the Duke started to view the half-eaten peach as a sign of offence. He started to twist it. Talk about gaslighting. So he started to twist that and be like, you presented me a bitten peach rather than the, you know, the really nice aspect of it.
I think it's with tales and legends that they get kind of misconstrued over time as well.
Yeah.
Do you know how reputable this this retelling of the story is, or do you think it's one of the stories that have been misconstrued over time through either different perspectives and different writers having to rewrite it?
Yeah. We don't have much information historically about the courtesan, but we do about the Duke. And we do know that same-sex relations in the imperial court happened a lot. At the time, we do know that after this event had happened, by the 12th century, those male courtesans no longer were in imperial power. Mm. So it's quite clear that that peach story had kind of gained momentum, so to speak. Because really, the primary goal in telling this story wasn't anti-same-sex relations. It was a cautionary tale about don't get too close to fickle rulers. Who one day will be your friend, the next day won't. Beware of your position in the imperial court and what that means. And I think over time, we started to see perhaps that become an image of same-sex behaviour. So it would become well-known throughout China, especially amongst the educated who read that and could read, less so amongst peasants.
Yeah.
But today it's still clung on, which is quite wonderful to see.
Yeah, I know in China and Eastern Asian cultures, I think I had learned about, what was it, with samurai and how they would keep partners of the same sex while they were out either in the field or out and about in battle because they're away from home from their wives, but they still need that, you know, that partnership. You have a very similar thing with like the Spartans who would also have male partners and to kind of brought that in a way like warriors bond And it made them fight better because they were fighting for love as opposed to just fighting for the sake of fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. Which stands in a strong contrast to the Victorians and Edwardians who outlawed same-sex relationships in Western armies.
It was seen more as a taboo by that point, but in more ancient times it was seen as, you know, if you weren't doing it, you were without. You were without love. You weren't fighting for love, and you weren't a better, in a way, you weren't a better soldier.
Absolutely. And the samurai saw same-sex love as being something that actually was the truest form of love, because it's the ultimate sacrifice for each other, to die by each other's side, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Die with honour, more importantly, especially in Japanese culture.
Mm-hmm. It's also very common across Asian cultures and their monarchies, where it's like whatever the emperor says goes. So if he ends up with a man, then you can't question the emperor. So specifically because of that reason, there's actually a lot of stories about an emperor being a bit fruity.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see, because it's like, they want it to be. It's like a lot of stories talk about people wanting to be discriminatory, but that's the emperor. They can't question it.
Yeah.
I know. With the bit in Peach, it also reminds me of the cut sleeve story.
Yes.
And I believe it was Edo, Japan.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that as well? Because I love this story personally.
Yeah, it's a great one. So it's one of the emperors who had a favourite love of his, who they had bounded together. He was quite a young emperor. He was Chinese.
Oh, yes.
And the fashion was to wear these long sleeves that kind of draped to the floor and things like this. And he fell asleep one day with the lover in his arms and woke up. And lo and behold, the lover was sleeping on his sleeve. Mm-hmm. So the idea is rather than kind of wake him up from his slumber, he cut the sleeve. And at that point, exactly what you're saying about people following the emperor, everybody did, because they realized at that point to have a cut sleeve become a fashion symbol in the imperial court. So at this point, everyone started to copy it. In fact, it was getting so concerning that, you know, even his mother started to think, you know, we need you to be maybe looking at women, you know, you need an heir. Got to pass this down somehow. But yeah, the cut sleeve has become a popular analogy as well. Really has.
That is a beautiful story.
What is the deal with queer people being compared to fruit?
This is it's a great question. So words fruit, fruity, fruitcake, all of the rest of them are kind of used a lot. It comes from Polari. So basically, Polari was, and as you all know, but for the listeners out there, Polari was a language spoken in the UK in plain sight of people who were heterosexual and cisgender. So it was a secret language spoken predominantly, but not exclusively, by gay men. And a lot of our terms today come from that, like the word naff to describe something as bad, or the word camp to describe something as outrageous.
I have given a brief look at Polari, and I've been trying to learn a few words here and there. Nice. Couldn't recite any off my head right now, but it has been interesting to see some words are like a mix between old Latin, in a way, and others a bit more modern words that have either replaced older words or a bit more derived from other meanings and other words for specific things, like the word butch for a lesbian who is a bit more, how would you say?
A bit more masculine.
A bit more masculine.
Yeah, absolutely. And it compares the idea from the Polari. I think the mean behind it was to compare kind of a gay man to a fruit is being soft and peachy, dare I say it. Going back to that bit in Peach, isn't it? Yeah. I wonder if there's a legacy there. But also, fascinatingly, there's elements of Cockney slang, rhyming slang, you know, like apples and pears for stairs and stuff like that. So basically, in Cockney rhyming slang, there's a term called cobbler's alls, which means your balls. And the idea of blow being a blossoming of a fruit tree, and was then widely used in Polari, it was copied from that Cockney rhyming a slang, to become a term for oval sex, as in the blossoming of the fruit. So there's all of this fruit stuff mixed in there. I mean, there's probably 100 other different reasons why we're compared to fruit. Personally, I love it. I think it's great.
I think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
You mentioned like Cockney ways of saying it. Is Polari a British language created by British people, or is it something far beyond that?
Yeah, some people have suggested actually it's an amalgamation of several different dialects languages. So it came from originally travelling folk, who were largely circus people, which was also, you have to bear in mind, a queer haven for a lot of people.
Yeah.
If you were different, if you were gender diverse in particular, you'd often join the circus where you'd meet your own, you'd be a lot safer. So it comes from travelling folk, also comes from the Navy. So many people were press-ganged into navies, i.e. forced into the Navy at the time. And so that was a significant thing. So the language developed on Navy ships and ended up coming onto shore. So it does come from the UK, in essence.
Okay.
But it also comes from outside other people's cultures and then led it to where it is today.
Yeah. I know you had a good question about the Hydra aphid.
I know I'm pretty sure it was across India. There is like, at least when it was like at its most popular, I don't think that's the right word, but you get what I mean.
Yes.
I don't know what region it's in now, but they still exist today, but I think it's just they're kind of floaty today, but it was all over like India.
Yeah, I know Drew might have a bit more on who the Hydra. We mentioned the name Hydra, but I don't think most people probably know who the Hydra are.
Yeah. So the Hydra are a gender diverse group of people. Then they have different terms, and you're absolutely right. South Asia, India before partition, before it was partitioned by the British and made into Pakistan, what was then called East Pakistan, which now we call Bangladesh. excuse me. So they've lived in that region now for over 2,000 years. They originally had a very exalted position of temple guardians and marriage blessers and things like that. They even mentioned the Kama Sutra. So next time you read the Kama Sutra for fun, or whatever reason you want to read the Kama Sutra, you'll hear about them widely. They are a third gender, in essence, and most Hydra, but not exclusively, are born male and express themselves as feminine. Some are intersex, and a lot, but not all, go through a castration ceremony called Nirvana. So it's a release. And basically, this goes back to one of the Hindu goddesses, who there's a story that says one of the Hindu goddesses came down to shore, said to all the people, if you're my loyal devotees, go away and spread words or whatever, and said specifically men and women. Now, everyone went away, did what they need to do, but then when the goddess came back, there was a group of people still stood there going, but we're not men or women. And this was the birth of the Hydra. Or so it's said to be. They live together in all Hydra communities. They're under, they're still prevalent today in India. Depends where you go in Southeast Asia, you'll call them something different. So if you're in Sri Lanka, for example, which is just, you know, island off India, you call them the Aravani. And maybe in South India, you call them Aravani as well. Hydra more north. Hey.
It's a very pretty name for
isn't it?
Even
lovely.
Hydra, it's so pretty.
Isn't it? It's lovely.
And then you'd mentioned like with like Hindu gods and stuff. A lot of Hindu gods are either asexual or can change from sex to sex.
Oh yeah.
The Hydra in a way I've always thought about this is embodying that aspect of gods, which is probably why they had them at weddings to kind of bless it.
Yeah.
Because you'd want your wedding to be, you know, holy or blessed by your gods.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting point that maybe has some connotation.
And it shows just how powerful they were for thousands of years. I mean, to be direct linked to Hindu pantheon of gods is huge. But that, however, has obviously changed. I mean, there's still 3 million Hydra living in India alone today. That's take away Pakistan, take away Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and Nepal. But that then ultimately came with a change because, as you all know, the British colonised what was then the large country of India, and the British were horrified by what they saw. The notion of a third gender to them was something that went against Victorian morals.
Yeah.
And so alongside doing that to other parts of the world and trying to stamp it out, the British brought in various penal codes to try to remove them from these quite beautiful temple ceremonial positions. And they started to spread misinformation campaigns, like the Hijra steal your young boys and castrate them. Not too dissimilar to the paedophilia stuff that gets wafted around. Yeah. You know what I mean? You can see these echoes, can't you, throughout time. And that led to the Indian Penal Code, but also the Criminal Tribes Act. So that was to ban Hijra from public areas, and that has had a knock-on effect now, where many of the Hijra still live with their gurus, they still live in their communities, but at the same time, a lot of them are isolated. They do still do wedding blessings. In actual fact, if you do not invite the Hijra to your wedding in India, they'll actually...
They'll, like, stand outside the door and, like, knock...
Yeah, they do. They'll stand outside of your door and they'll shout at you until you pay them to go.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not to be messed with, to be fair. Yeah. They're really not. But a lot have lost that original high social status. And now they get by with begging, with sex work and things like that. But times are changing. So by 2014, the governments of India, Pakistan and Nepal and Bangladesh all allowed for Hijra to be recognised in official documentation. So the binary is gone. So you can have an X on your passport for third gender, an X on your national ID, things like this.
It's a big step.
It's a huge step. Mm. And there's a hope there that will return back potentially to the way things were a little better.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wish them luck. I really do, because there's 3 million of them there. You know, they're not going to go away, despite what the British tried to do.
Yeah.
I have a question I want to ask, like, all of you here. What is your favourite aspect of queer history, of everything that you've either looked into or of what we've talked about today? I'd like to know.
Shall I go first?
Yeah.
Okay. I struggle with this one because, and I wrote down things and I scribbled them out and I wrote down things. And
yeah, a lot of knowledge on this.
I think I would, if I had to go to that time period in particular, I'd like to go back to the Abbasid Caliphate. So this was the huge part of the Middle East, because I love the Middle East. I'm a big fan of it. And in that caliphate was massive. I mean, it spanned all of modern-day Gulf Arab states, all the way across North Africa, right into Spain, which is why you still see Islamic designs in Spain. And if you go to Granada, there's a huge impact of Islam there. And it was massive. And with that was a period of opening up. We saw the world's first universities. We saw places of flowering scientific invention, not inhibited by religion, actually allowed to exist because of it. Growing because of it. Yet we, you know, in Europe sat in the dark ages and picked our bums with sticks.
Yeah.
And so all of our stuff was repressed. This was a period of bringing the ancient philosophers back to life.
Yeah.
And I would love to have seen that. I would love to have traveled around that area. I think it'd be fascinating.
Yeah. What was like your favorite aspect of like queer history? Because
learning more about the Hijra, probably that, but in more recent terms, probably around the 70s or 80s when like ballroom culture became bigger, because I love that type of stuff.
And David, yeah?
This is difficult for me. I do quite like the Hijra. I also quite like the fact that in like there's so much evidence that in several different like tribes around the world that there's either third genders or homosexuality or lesbianism. Like, it's so common, but like I don't know whether we choose to ignore it, but even though like there's so many documentaries on these separate tribes, like they'll just be like their attitude towards like gender. They're just like, okay, that's who that person is. Why should we tell them they're not?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why we kind of lost that as people. And it became, I just love how they are. And that the fact that they have that philosophy, it's great.
I would say it's a very cheap answer to this question myself. Basically, all of it. Like, I'm a history nerd. I love every aspect of it, with the Salafis, with the Egyptians, with the Hijra, with Eastern Asia. All of it is just so interesting. And the fact that it used to be so normalized and so everyone was, I would say, used to it. It was just an aspect of life. But over time, as new nations rise and new empires rise and new rules and guidelines and ideologies take over, so much of queer history is either forgotten or shunned. And that's something I think is a shame, because we've mentioned about so many things today where it's just so beautiful. And I think the one thing we need in this world is beauty, especially when it comes from history and people specifically.
I think a lot of it seems like, since we were so focused on survival and just organising a bunch of things, that like that was like the least of our priorities. But now we've kind of gotten to a point where we don't have to worry about that. It's like we and our brains need to find something to be mad about or be stressed about or hate or something like that. It's a really strange thing that's kind of happened with us, because like we've mentioned, like cavemen, different tribes, a Hydra, and that's so many different eras of humans. Yeah. And it's always existed in that, but somehow once we've got to this point, it seems all about control rather than just people being themselves.
But we also have to remember that during these time eras, they were still controlled as well.
Yes.
And, you know, it was the Emperor Nero himself of Rome who said, "Bread, give them bread and circuses." If the public have a full stomach and they've got entertainment to watch, meaning chariot shows, they'll be amused. And that lesson hasn't changed 2,000 and a half years later. Yeah. So we've always been, there's always been periods of tolerance in this, but we shouldn't also put romantic views onto it. Because also there will have been periods in here of harsh punishments and all sorts that go alongside with it.
And I feel like in the this current age, with the fact that with technology, on with the internet, and with being able to call someone, I could pick up my phone now and call someone across the country, or even in a different country if possible. That sense of so much open communication with everyone has allowed the spread of the hate and the ideologies that in general, like anything to do with like the LGBTQ plus community, just the hate towards it has been able to spread so easily because communication is so accessible, so widespread. And while it is great in another sense, the age of communication has really brought the world together, it has also torn the world apart in some ways.
And I think this is, perhaps on a final note, to say this is why it's so important to bring this up. It's why we need to cut through some of that mess, through some of that comms, to actually say, you know what, queer people have always been here. We've always existed. Don't try to say that we're otherwise. Mm-hmm. So when your Mugabes of the world stand up and say it comes from the West, we can say, well, actually, it doesn't. Yeah. You know, we can fire back with some of these arguments. Say, we've always been in your neighbourhoods. We've lived next door to you. We're your sons, your brothers, your mothers, your son, fathers. We can do that. That's important.
Yeah, I think that's our time for today. But don't worry, this is just episode one. Tune into our next podcast, episode two, Our History, where we share our stories. This has been the Drop-In Queer Edition, the Unspoken Queer History. Until next time.